Good morning. Welcome to Deadly Days, Tales of Dark Fantasy. This is episode 50. Hard to believe we got 50 episodes out, but this will be 50. I'm trying to hope. I hope everybody's enjoying these. There's a lot more to come. I translate these stories and by myself, so that's where we come. And then I publish them. I'm just gonna quickly mention my online bookstore. That's at bandlebooks.com. Bandle is like B-A-N-D-E-L, band like a rock and roll band, el.com. And that will take you to my webpage that has links that'll get you just about any place you need to go. Check it out. I'm kind of proud of that. I'm trying to revamp everything and get everything more organized so it's easier for people to find what they're looking for. I've got several authors there that I've translated, and in fact I'm just going to stop at that and I'm just going to start reading. Today's episode is The Wonder of Oberpurzelsheim. It's from the magazine Cocaine. A novella by George Hirschfeld. In Oberpurzelsheim, which lies between Schmusingen and Schmokeritz on the Luper, the most remarkable thing happened that was stranger than anything even the oldest people could remember. Even the strange events that happened in their great-great-grandfather's times. That means, firstly, that Oberpurzelsheim was rich in very old people, and second, that nothing remarkable had ever happened in the little town that was worth talking about. Life in this place was not really any different from that in other nests. The residents achieved recognition and wealth through sheep breeding. Their moderate political views, their piety, and their equanimity never let them deviate from what down through time has been called genuine small-town life. They nurtured and prospered honestly, yet whether it should be called a shining blessing or a sad doom, there was some type of spell lying over Oberpurzelsheim. What caused them? The whimsical, grotesque designs. What cast pointed shadows everywhere and formed mysterious angles? Perhaps it was an atmospheric phenomenon that only lay above Oberpurzelsheim and created rays of uncommon colors. It could not be explained. Heaven must have had a hand in it, because the Oberpurzelsheimers would forbid any influence from hell. In any case, some force acted there so that on bright days the already colored alleys took on a look as if a heavenly painter had painted them to make a pretty toy for bored angels. Crimson roofs towered over sulfur yellow house fronts. Bright blue shutters were no longer smothered by the green of climbing flowers. Nearby, the brown fences asserted themselves, and the bulb of the church tower was not a neutral, weather-resistant black, but a cheerful lilac. Everyone who came to Oberpurzelsheim became colorblind or fell under the same delusion. The globular plaster did not appear gray, but a mosaic of shimmering semi-precious stones. But of course, only when the sun was shining. But the sun shone most of the time in Oberpurzelsheim. is shown so shamelessly golden and from such a blue sky above that even the horrified eye could find no rest from it. And if you took a closer look around the town, the reality would seem completely like a fairy tale to you. Didn't the children wear red caps, yellow jackets, and blue trousers? Didn't the teacher have a veritable lion's head? And didn't the pastor look like a bulldog prepared to fight? That disguised duck over there is the wife of the mayor, and waddling at her arm is her nephew, a tiny dwarf. The sexton, who is leaning against the church door, is a giant, because his head reaches up into the Gothic archway. It is certain that the stone statue of the knight, which stands on the delicate fountain in the market square, awakens on full moon nights and shakes with swarming girls. That the animals in Oberpurzelsheim sometimes lose their silence, and Madame Cat and Monsieur Dog converse reasonably with humans, and that furthermore, in the kitchen of the Golden Hare, it is not uncommon to hear nighttime noises, and in the morning find two battered copper kettles on the floor, along with the spoons they were dueling with. There is no doubt about any of this. There must be a second, unknown, demonic life behind it, which no one can sniff out. The citizens lie a lot, and occasionally a bloody deed is discovered in a remote alley. Known crooks have come from Oberpurzelsheim. Its fearfully healthy laziness also gave rise to two geniuses, a philosopher who went mad and a crippled painter. That is suspicious. Mr. Leopold Rorick, owner of the market pharmacy, was by no means one of the geniuses of his hometown, but he was very satisfied with himself. His extraordinarily mundane profession of always making the same pills, grinding the same powders, and mixing the same ointments. There were no special needs in Oberpurzelsheim. Unfortunately, it gave Mr. Rorick lots of time to think. This pharmacist's thinking apparatus was his pride and the undoing of his fellow citizens. His iron vocal cords gifted him with a dialectic that simply overwhelmed less eloquent people. Mr. Rorich always won what he spoke. You could not even call his one-sided speeches gossip. That was the worst thing about it. There was no need to listen to a babbler, because his flow of speech would simply be empty sounds. But the pharmacist knew what he was talking about. Newcomers that had not already been caught in his web were enticed by a theme the sharp-witted pharmacist threw out as bait. As soon as the other took the bait and tried to share their own differing opinion, Mr. Rorich would pick their brains and out-argue the unfortunate, who grew more and more excited. In the end, he simply talked them down. Every visit to the market pharmacy, whether the medication was ready or just being prepared, took at least an hour if Mr. Rorich had his way. The smartest people, therefore, only opened the door a crack, stick their head in and then duck back out at lightning speed if they saw the pharmacist. Mr. Hintertosser, the absent-minded clerk, who had already suffered a mental breakdown through talks with his boss, served with mechanical speed. But if you were standing inside the pharmacy and Mr. Rorick showed up, there was no escaping. You had to wait for the medicine and watch how the nimble, fleshy hands worked the delicate scales, while the wide-open mouth, which was surrounded by a fluffy beard, spoke incessantly. The customer was dismissed with an aching head, ashamed and angry at the wasted time, of which he was only now conscious of. At the door, Mr. Rorich was still filling them in on the final details of his worldview. It had already happened that patients waiting in vain for their life-saving medications had died, and it could be presumed that these citizens of Oberpürzelsheim had stayed away from Mr. Rorich for their own protection. But there was no other pharmacy in the town. The family was of the upper class, and Leopold was one of the richest men in town. He sat in the magistrate, where, out of diplomacy, he spoke very little, but managed to put everything through. Still, this man's luck would not have been such a strong and impregnable forest if it had not been for his wife, Laura. Leopold Rutsch did not think of her as an ideal spouse, even though after the first year she gave him a son, and according to her husband, that was enough to fulfill her marriage obligation, because now he had a son to inherit the pharmacy. Furthermore, she was a pretty, gentle being with the head of a Madonna, and her dark eyes looked with a serious goodness at life. She was also business-minded, knew the medications, and calculated correctly. But what made her undesirable to Leopold Rorich, however, was a serious shortcoming that earned her a deep sympathy from everybody else. Laura was mute. Fortunately, not deaf and mute, just mute. The carelessness of her stepmother in not fighting back against this affliction, which she had been born with, had increased her isolation to the point that you never heard a word from her. But the pharmacist took the pretty, pale girl as his wife, and no one could imagine how inspired, how deliberately he did it. Not only because of her dowry, but because she could also listen to him like no one else in the world would. Laura, in the truest sense, literally became his creature. No matter how much she wanted to share her own convictions, how much she was moved to resist, she could not speak, could not interrupt Mr. Rorich. A gentle smile, a devoted Chinese nod was her part. That is what Leopold required of his wife. In the beginning, during the courtship, he had been cleverly attentive to her. He had awoken the slumbering fantasies of the mute girl, and no one had ever paid attention to her before. Now this rich, powerful pharmacist had come and considered her worthy enough to share his thoughts with her. Up until a month after the marriage, it was a pleasure to listen to Rorich. Then she realized how he had trapped her. He never stopped talking, and her nerves shook. Her poor body remained in a dull anger. She had to listen, because when she fell asleep, Rorich got upset. Yes, he became brutal and forced her to pay attention. His sharp eyes bored into her through his polished glasses. There was nothing left for her to do but be the audience for everything clever and stupid, refined and crude, that passed over the pharmacist's tongue. In the first year, Laura silently lamented inside, considering herself unworthy, never suspecting the slavery that she had fallen into. Her cruel husband deliberately kept her away from all other people because their pity could have stirred her up. He was seldom seen with her on the streets or in church. There were only the Sunday promenades in the town forest, where she had to take his arm and show her gentle smile of happiness. Mr. Rorich had no love for the theater, and it was only during the few concerts in the winter that Laura was happy she would have been to sing at the piano at home. Strangely, despite her being mute, she believed that she had a beautiful voice. She always heard herself singing, and she had learned all of Schubert's songs. But Laura had been born in Oberpürzelsheim. Apathy was a foundational element of its population, and so it also ruled over the life of the poor pharmacist's wife. She did not commit suicide. She had an appetite, slept well, and enjoyed her healthy boy. Since she was interested in medicine, and was able to use her good botanical knowledge, she was able to manage her own happiness. Secretly, she finally won a counterweight against Rutsch. She nursed a reserved but strong and deeply burning feeling of revenge against the pharmacist. She hated him because she felt offended and abused by him. But this proud feeling was enough for her, and even though it gave her the ability to finally resist, she did not act upon it. On a hot summer day, the rare case occurred when the pharmacist, Rurich, left his wife and child at home alone and traveled with his bowling club, Saunagil, of which he was the chairman, to the neighboring village of Krumsenbach. Laura had been looking forward to this doubly quiet day for a long time. She fulfilled little Heinrich's request to go for a half-hour walk, and then enjoyed the sweet laziness and comfort of her home until the evening. It was unbearably humid outside. The excursion of the bowling club, Saunagil, was certainly not going to be a pleasure. Smiling, Laura envisioned Rorich in his shirt sleeves, entirely wet and exhausted, walking down a dusty country road. Certainly a few of the bowling brothers would stop and remain lying on the side of the road, not from sunstroke, but to avoid the long speech of the pharmacist, which they had endured already for hours today. Laura could laugh at the thought of it, a faint giggling laugh that sounded as if it came through a veil. Today she was free of Mr. Rorich. She danced happily around the room. Little Heinrich, who had never seen his mother like this, asked her in a loud voice to play a game. But the only games she had to offer her child were pitiful because she could not tell him fairy tales, and everything had to remain in dramatic gestures. But she willingly did as Heinrich requested. She knew a graceful, lively, and funny pantomime that she performed with him, in which she often dressed up and crawled around on all fours. The quiet pharmacist's house echoed with happy laughter, and the astonished old maid came in to see what was going on. Finally, as dusk was falling, the playful Heinrich got tired, and Laura put him to bed. Now she was all alone in the old angular house, because the maid was over chatting with the neighbor. The loneliness felt both good and bad at the same time. Slowly she went over to the piano and leafed through Schubert's songs that always stood open there. She played the accompaniment very softly. Her lips moved along, and without a sound, she sang Spring's Belief. Violet twilight was still shining through the window. The corners of the room were already in darkness. Laura wanted it to be completely night. Today, she choked on the songs that she could not sing. She became more restless. The darker it became, unable to see the notes, and closed her eyes. Her hot hands remained on the cool keys. Then she felt the tears stream from her breast, which had never been opened, which she had repressed out of fear and duty. They sought release. They were not mute. They were the voice of life. She huddled deep in her sorrow. Then she suddenly heard the thunder of a thunderstorm outside. That was why it became dark so quickly. Raindrops rolled on the windows. A pale yellowish glow came and lit the darkened room in a ghostly way. An extraordinary weather had accumulated. Now the many glowing days demanded their tribute. It never occurred to her that her husband and his bowling club were on their way home without any protection. She only hurried to calm her son, who had been awakened by the thunderstorm and was crying fearfully. But Laura could not console him as needed, because there was something rushed about her consoling. At this hour she was no longer a mother, and her soul, released, sought after the unleashed elements. She stared out the window as she stroked Heinrich. He eyed his mother fearfully. Never had he feared her muteness. Today he saw that a demon raged in her, that she wanted to speak, but not to the everyday common people. It spasmed in her sunken, childish throat. She groaned and sobbed, and oh horror, when a thunderclap came outside, she nodded as if saying, "Yes." The weather grew even more threatening. The flash of lightning and thunderclap followed immediately. The ghostly flickering brightness became constant. Then the old maid came in, soaking wet. She had been over at the neighbor's, but her conscience had driven her back. The appearance of the thin woman who had raised her skirt over her head for protection from the weather terrified Heinrich, even though he knew the maid very well. He screamed out loud and hid behind his mother. In that exact moment, the room was wrapped in a yellow fire. Laura grabbed Heinrich to her and sank to the floor, but she never lost consciousness. It was only as if God's fist had seized her throat and shaken the entire body of the woman violently back and forth. She pulled herself together, and something inside her was miraculously freed. She knew immediately that Heinrich was all right. Only the maid continued to whine. The lightning had come through the window and struck the stove, and then the drain pipe, which had carried it down into the basement. The house did not burn, and the weather calmed after that final explosion. Heinrich whimpered softly and wrapped his arms around his mother's neck. "Are you hurt, Mama?" was his first question. Then he heard her answer in a nameless excitement, without being at all surprised. "No, my child, are you?" She heard herself and froze. From outside, excited voices came closer. It was the bowling club that had come home and wanted to help its chairman because it was said that the lightning had struck the pharmacy, but there was no sign of a fire. But what had happened to the woman and child? Leopold Rourke ran into his house ahead of them all. He cried out in joy when Laura and Heinrich ran to him well and whole. He already wanted to describe the power of the thunderstorm to her, how he had experienced it out on the road, and give a detailed account of how they had survived such dangers. That was when the once obliging Laura interrupted him with a great effort. A strange, clear, rejoicing voice rang out toward him. "I can talk, Leopold. I can talk." The pharmacist reeled back. That voice, as if it came from heaven, childlike and victorious. But he was filled with dread like a devil that has been struck down by angels. He stared at the transformed woman with dismay. "Aren't you happy?" "The lightning," cried Laura in great excitement. Yes, it was her voice, but he was not happy about it. It grabbed him by the throat and squeezed, and he flailed his arms like a drowning man. He did not want to hear his wife's voice. What did this figure want of him? Why was she coming closer, laughing brightly and speaking? It was completely strange to him. Then the Bowling brothers entered the room. They saw that the pharmacist was about to faint, pressed around him, and fearfully asked what was wrong with him. But Rourke, the mighty of speech, only moved his lips. He pointed desperately to his throat, which did not make a sound, while Laura, with exquisite elegance, explained the miracle that had happened to her. The pharmacist stared and nodded as if it were God speaking. He remained a healthy, energetic man, but no one ever heard another word from him. Laura's finally released flow of speech was inexhaustible. They lived with each other for a long time and were able to hand over the pharmacy to their son. These were the most wonderful couple of Oberpürzelsheim. That was the place where crimson roofs towered over sulfur yellow fronts, and the bulb of the church tower was not black, but lilac. And that's the end of that story, episode number 50. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.